Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Gavin, and I'm reading the Big Bend Sentinel, published Wednesday, March 24th, 2021. COVID vaccinations open to all Texans on Monday, by Big Bend Sentinel. Starting next Monday, March 29th, all adults will be eligible to receive a COVID-19 vaccine in Texas. The Texas Department of State Health Services said it's made great strides in vaccinating people, and that its expert vaccine allocation panel is therefore now recommending opening vaccinations to everybody. The agency also says it expects vaccine supplies to increase next week. As the supply increases, the state says it will soon have the resources to vaccinate anyone who's old enough to receive one. That age limit varies slightly by shot. Most vaccines have an age limit of 18, while the Pfizer vaccine is open to everyone 16 or older. More than 9.3 million Texans, or around one-third of the state, have already been vaccinated, including around 3 million who have been fully vaccinated. We want to keep up the momentum as the vaccine supply increases, Imelda Garcia, DSHS Associate Commissioner for Laboratory and Infectious Disease Services and the chair of the Expert Vaccine Allocation Panel, said in a statement. Regardless, older people and people with increased risk factors will still be prioritized. DSHS has directed vaccine providers to prioritize people 80 years old or older when scheduling appointments. The agency is asking providers to immediately move those patients to the front of the line, whether or not they have an appointment. That will help ease the burden on older and higher-risk patients, the agency says. Those over the age of 80 have been disproportionately affected by severe cases of COVID-19 and have recorded the highest death rates from the disease. Also next week, DSHS will launch a website and toll-free number to allow people to register for a shot through some public health providers. The public will be able to enroll in the Texas Public Health Vaccine Scheduler to identify upcoming vaccine clinics hosted by DSHS or a participating local health department and be notified when new clinics and appointments become available. In the meantime, more information is available at dshs.texas.gov/COVID-vaccine. Amid rising migrant numbers, residents call for pathway to legal immigration. There have always been problems on the border, one local said. This is just a continuation of that. By Abby Peralt and Stephen Paulson. As the number of migrants crossing through the southern border in the Big Bend region climbs to heights not seen in recent years, there's a growing sense of desperation among both locals and migrants themselves. Law enforcement officials report being overwhelmed. Immigrants are perishing in remote corners of the region, and a group of West Texas landowners are organizing to demand reforms that could help alleviate traffic, property damage, and thefts on their land. Earlier this month, a meeting organized by landowners brought together around 50 local elected officials, law enforcement, state and federal politicians, and concerned residents to discuss these issues and possible solutions. Calling themselves Concerned Far West Texans for Legal Immigration, they warn the region is facing a dire situation if desperate migrants and human smugglers continue to traffic through the area. According to statistics from U.S. Customs and Border Protection, the increase in the Big Bend is driven largely by lone adult migrants. More than 10,000 adult migrants have crossed in the Big Bend so far this fiscal year, compared to around 2,500 this time last year. The Big Bend has also seen the biggest increase in unaccompanied migrant children, up 165% since February 2020, when compared to other southwest border sectors. Around 600 unaccompanied children have been apprehended in the Big Bend region since the fiscal year began in October 2020, compared to around 200 last year in that same time period. The reasons for the increasing number of migrants is complex, with CBP citing ongoing violence, natural disasters, food insecurity, and poverty in the Northern Triangle countries of Central America. Fairly or not, some migrants may also sense that President Joe Biden will be more welcoming than former President Donald Trump, who instituted myriad policies aimed to keep immigrants from entering the United States. The reality is more complex. Biden has removed some aspect of Trump's immigration policy, like the Migrant Protection Protocols, MPP, and border wall construction, while keeping others, including Title 42, which allows immigration officials to promptly deport migrants during a health crisis like the coronavirus pandemic. Regardless, the MPP, or Remain in Mexico policy, which required asylum seekers to wait in makeshift camps in Mexico for their immigration hearings, has created a backlog of people eager to make their asylum claims and reunite with family in the United States. While immigrants make the trip for a wide variety of reasons, resident Shelley Means says most of them are unprepared for the difficult terrain they will encounter in West Texas, calling it an insane trek. In September, three migrants died while trying to cross through Presidio County. Then, in January, two more died of cold exposure near Sanderson. These are just a tiny fraction of the recent migrant deaths along the U.S.-Mexico border. Border Patrol estimates hundreds of migrants die attempting to cross the southern border every year. They think they can hike it. I'm sure they can better than any of us. But when they get in those weather conditions, that's when they're dehydrated, Means said. Officials from the Big Bend sector of Border Patrol have long discussed their role as search and rescue, providing aid to immigrants who struggled along the rugged terrain in intense heat or cold, and blaming coyotes, the people migrants pay to secure safe passage into the U.S., for mischaracterizing the trip. They're promised a land of milk and honey when they get to Valentine, Means said. And, well, Valentine is nothing. You can't buy a loaf of bread or a tank of gas. The ranch Means owns is a frequent route for immigrant traffic, and as more have arrived, she says trash, clothes, and even drugs litter the property. Recently, Means encountered a group of Guatemalan men hiding out near her home. She offers to feed anyone who arrives at her door, knowing they've likely just traveled 7 to 9 days on foot. I call the Border Patrol first, then I go render aid, she said. Then I pray the Border Patrol hurries up. They don't scare me. What I am fearful for really is my mom's safety, Means said. My mom is almost 80, and she's had people kick her door in, walking into her house demanding food. It became a motivating factor for Means to gather the concerned Far West Texans group. Means has also had fire set on her property, and she's not alone. Two Fridays ago, Albert Miller's son saw a plume of smoke rising while on Valentine. Something on the family's nearby Miller ranch was ablaze, and the flames ultimately caused a loss of a structure on the property. The culprit was an immigrant who had given up on their perilous crossing and attempted to surrender by lighting a fire to draw Border Patrol's attention and assistance. The Border Patrol apprehended an immigrant there who reportedly confessed to setting the fire, Miller said. Miller, a managing partner of the family ranch, had lived in West Texas for more than 70 years. He doesn't remember a time where this many people have traversed his land at once. I don't know that we feel less safe, but we're probably taking it more carefully. We're certainly more aware of what's going on, but as far as our day-to-day activities, it's not changed a lot, Miller said. There have always been problems on the border, and this is just a continuation of that. He's not sure what the solution is to prevent the trespassing or stop the property destruction that West Texas landowners are reporting. I wish those people didn't have to come to the United States. I wish they could just make a living and be safe in their own country, he said. I think that's wishful thinking, but I think they wish the same thing. In the petition by concerned Far West Texans, the group outlines an increase in traffic that they say has led to delayed response times for an overwhelmed Border Patrol, fires that endanger livestock, home invasions, and theft. We in no way want to keep them from coming to America for a better way of life. The stand that we are trying to make is that we want legal immigration, the open letter reads. It asks for an immigration pathway that provides jobs to immigrants and provides a better quality of life for immigrants and for citizens that live on the border, ensuring a, quote, sense of peace and security in our own homes and homelands. The letter, which has gained hundreds of signatures, also details a strain on law enforcement, saying response times from Border Patrol have slowed as more individuals are crossing at once. What it's affecting is law enforcement, because they're overwhelmed, said Presidio County Sheriff Danny Dominguez. Across the region, law enforcement say they're handling more migrant situations as well as responding to related public safety issues like the ranch fires. This week, Dominguez's department was involved in a car chase in Presidio that ended when the vehicle drove across a low spot in the Rio Grande and returned to Mexico. We have those all the time now, Dominguez said. referencing human smugglers evading law enforcement and leading them on high-speed chases. That's one of my main concerns, is that increase. I don't want something tragic to happen to local citizens, visitors, or those people we're after. The same is true in Brewster County, where Sheriff Ronnie Dodson estimates he and his deputies are encountering more than twice as many migrants as they were last year. He estimates the number started picking up around November and thinks the election of Joe Biden inspired some immigrants to try their luck crossing. When the election came, he said, they started coming, and those are just the migrants they do find, sometimes. We find evidence where we missed what we call getaways, Dodson said, including backpacks and empty water bottles. In Presidio City, Police Chief Margarito Hernandez says he and his officers are also dealing with, quote, a lot more migrants. Also, the pursuits are increasing, he said. We rarely had pursuits before. Now it seems like 3 pursuits a month, something like that. He noted that undocumented migrants faced a heightened possibility of becoming victims of abuse, as unscrupulous smugglers in workplaces try to dodge authorities. On Saturday, the department responded to a call about 4 migrants hiding in a house near town. The Big Bend Sentinel has not yet seen an incident report on that case. The Biden administration has taken steps this week to try and contain the influx of undocumented immigrants and asylum seekers, asking the Defense Department to open Fort Bliss in El Paso to house unaccompanied migrant children, and discussing the opening of a property named Target Lodge Pecos North to house 500 to 2,000 children temporarily, which matches the name of a property in Pecos. Media is not being allowed entrance to the facilities temporarily housing migrants, but photographs and footage released by Congressman Henry Queller of a South Texas facility show immigrant children watching TV and sleeping on mats on the floor, all while tightly packed in spaces that offer little chance of social distancing during an ongoing pandemic. Despite the risk, many are still braving the dangers of the journey, including people who have previously lived in the United States. The other day, Sheriff Dodson picked up a group that included a man who said he had lived in Oklahoma with his family. The man was arrested for a DWI and deported back to Mexico, where he was wary to even take trips to the grocery store for fear of being shaken down for bribes by Mexican military and police. They were lost and hungry, very hungry, Dodson said. They ate up all my emergency snacks. But the former Oklahoman, he said, seemed honest and very forthcoming and had job skills. He still has an ex-wife and kids in Oklahoma, and he wants to be close to them, Dodson said. There's a lot of that. For opportunistic criminals, humans have become a good commodity for smugglers, Dodson said. But once the coyotes make it into the United States, they frequently abandon stragglers and leave migrants to fend for themselves. Meanwhile, he said, regional businesses are struggling with labor shortages and just can't get help. He thinks some kind of reform or job program could go a long way towards easing the rising number of undocumented immigrants by offering desperate migrants a pathway to employment while keeping them off of private land and out of harm's way. Local hospital faces scrutiny after charging for vaccines, by Stephen Paulson. A Far West Texas hospital could be in hot water after it said in a social media post earlier this month that it was charging patients for COVID-19 vaccines. The post from Pecos County Memorial Hospital in Fort Stockton invited people to come get a Johnson & Johnson brand COVID-19 vaccine, but said it would, quote, charge an administration fee of $15 for people who wanted a shot. The Texas Department of State Health Services, which is helping oversee the vaccine rollout in Texas, was emphatic that vaccine providers are not allowed to charge patients. Rules circulated by the CDC and the CMS, the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, also make it clear that patients cannot be charged. In an email this week, a spokesperson for Texas DSHS stressed that getting a COVID-19 vaccine is completely free, and that providers may not charge a recipient any out-of-pocket cost for administering it. The CDC rules are clear, the spokesperson added, and all providers agree to those rules when they enroll as a COVID-19 vaccine provider. She pointed to rules from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, which say that providers, quote, must administer COVID-19 vaccine at no out-of-pocket cost. They also say providers may not charge an office visit or other fee if COVID-19 vaccination is the sole medical service provided. It may not deny anyone vaccination, based on details like their insurance status. Rules from CMS are also clear on that matter. A news release circulated by CMS this month says that, as a condition of receiving free COVID-19 vaccines from the federal government, vaccine providers are prohibited from charging patients any amount for administration of the vaccine. It's unclear how the hospital acquired its vaccines. Johnson & Johnson did not respond to a request for comment. Pecos County Memorial Hospital initially did not respond to multiple requests for comment on this issue. However, when told about the statement from DSHS, a spokesperson stressed that the $15 charge was for the visit, not the vaccine. It's an administration fee, the spokesperson added. People are charged an administration fee for the visit, but the vaccine is free. When asked in a follow-up email about the distinction, a DSHS spokesperson said that while hospitals may bill insurance companies for administrative costs, they cannot charge the patient any fee directly. The Big Bend Sentinel asked to speak with hospital executives about this issue, but at press time, we have not yet heard back to them. The hospital spokesperson said she was unsure how many people were charged for the vaccine and directed further questions to hospital executives. After watching body cam footage, grand jury declines to indict deputy in Marathon shooting, by Stephen Paulson. A Brewster County grand jury last week declined to indict a deputy who fatally shot a woman near Marathon in December. The woman killed in the shooting, 27-year-old Evett Hernandez of Alpine, left behind two children, aged 6 and 10. The deputy, who has now been identified as Bianca De La Rosa, also shot herself in the hand. Sheriff Ronnie Dodson says the damage from that injury may be permanent. Among the evidence the grand jury reviewed was De La Rosa's body cam footage from that night, which the Big Bend Sentinel attained through a public records request now that the case is closed. The video shows Hernandez struggling and physically fighting with De La Rosa prior to the shooting. It also shows that De La Rosa tried to de-escalate the situation, including using non-lethal methods to try and subdue Hernandez. A taped Texas Rangers interview with De La Rosa from February, which was also part of grand jury evidence, provides further context on what led up to the altercation. De La Rosa, working as a deputy in Marathon, said she got a call from the Gage Hotel about an incident at the bar on December 9, 2020, the night of the shooting. Staff told her two female customers were being belligerent and would not leave, according to the interview. Those customers also left behind some of their belongings. When De La Rosa arrived at the Gage, Hernandez and her friend had already left. Workers said they were heading west on US 90 towards Alpine, according to De La Rosa. She told Rangers she went to look for them. She found them parked on the side of the highway outside of town. The body cam video starts with De La Rosa approaching the car. Hernandez and her friend, who had still not been publicly identified, are standing on the passenger side of the car. De La Rosa asks Hernandez for her ID, but she doesn't provide it. They argue for a couple minutes. Hernandez tells her friend to get in the car and walks back over to the driver's side, followed by De La Rosa. De La Rosa says she smells alcohol. De La Rosa tries to place Hernandez in handcuffs, and they struggle for a couple more minutes. "I was trying to cuff her or get control of her," De La Rosa says in her interview with Rangers. "I couldn't, at all." "Stop fighting with me because I will tase you," De La Rosa says in the body cam video. The struggle escalates and the action in the video becomes increasingly difficult to follow. De La Rosa draws her taser and points it at Hernandez, but nothing happens. De La Rosa told Rangers she didn't think it was working. Hernandez grabs at the taser. In the struggle, the body cam gets dislodged and falls off. De La Rosa puts it back on, it falls off again. The pair can't be seen, but they sound relatively far away. Around this point, De La Rosa says she managed to subdue Hernandez. "I had control of her then," she told Rangers, but De La Rosa said they were in a street and she worried an oncoming truck would hit them. "I didn't want to let her up until somebody came, but I had no choice." Suddenly, around 10 minutes into the body cam footage, they sound close again. There's more sounds of physical struggle. Someone, apparently De La Rosa, repeatedly yells stop. In a tearful section of the Rangers interview, De La Rosa gives her version of what happened in those final seconds. "I got pretty far away from her," she said. "I thought maybe she'll get in the car and then leave. Instead, she said Hernandez ran at me and started punching me. At that point, I knew she was not going to stop. She wanted to fight. De La Rosa told Rangers, Hernandez started grabbing at her taser again. I remember thinking, if she gets it out, she's going to tase me and then she's going to kill me, she said. She pulled her service weapon and she said Hernandez started grabbing at that weapon too. She was pushing Hernandez back with her left hand. In the seconds before the shooting, they bump into the body cam and knock it up towards the sky. De La Rosa has her gun drawn. Hernandez was reaching towards her. They're on screen for a second, then off. There's a single gunshot. It happened real fast, De La Rosa told Rangers. Hernandez died at the scene. An autopsy reports that she died of a single gunshot wound to the chest. A toxicology report shows she was very intoxicated, with blood alcohol levels over twice the legal limit for driving. It also shows she had THC, an active component of marijuana, in her system. De La Rosa could not be reached for comment, and Brewster County Sheriff Ronnie Dodson said she did not want to comment on the incident. He said De La Rosa was in counseling and uncertain if she would continue a career in law enforcement. We're sorry for the incident completely, Sheriff Dodson said. We don't like situations like that. But these officers, especially these deputies, are out in these rural areas by themselves with no backup. There was a family who lost somebody, he added, and the deputy herself, she's healing. You don't just grab a bottle of whiskey like you see on TV. She emotionally went through some things. It's not easy to take someone's life. As for Hernandez's family, they're also still reeling from the tragedy. Hernandez's immediate family, including a father and sister, cannot be reached for comment. Chris Roman, a cousin who grew up with Hernandez, said neither was interested in talking. Roman, who knew Hernandez as EJ, says he'll remember her as a doting mother who loved to cook and watch scary movies. Her mother and stepmother died when Hernandez was young, and Roman said Hernandez wanted to give her daughters the full mother experience. She was constantly doing things for them, Roman said. She always had them looking good, their hair done, taking pictures. She was very involved. Roman said he talked to Hernandez basically every day. The last time he saw her alive was about a week before she died. She had come up to Odessa, where Roman lives, to visit the grave of her mother. They got lunch. Afterwards, Roman recalled, Hernandez told him she loved him. She started dancing in the street outside the restaurant. I turned away because I couldn't stop laughing, he recalled. I'm grateful that that was the last physical memory I have of her. Marathon Public Library named finalists for 2021 IMLS National Medal for Museum and Library Service by Big Ben Sentinel. The Institute of Museum and Library Services announced last Thursday that Marathon Public Library is among 30 finalists for the 2021 National Medal for Museum and Library Service. Marathon Public Library is the only institution in Texas selected as a finalist for this award. Marathon Public Library is honored to be recognized for the services it provides to a community that values its public library, said Board President Aaron Albright. This nomination highlights the dedication and hard work of our staff who work with many individuals and community partners to create innovative, engaging programs that have a deep and long-lasting impact on our community. We are so fortunate that our patrons and visitors support our library in so many ways. They're committed to our children, teen, and adult programs. They enjoy the breadth and depth of our collections, and they depend on the library for technology services that help bridge the digital divide, said Albright. It is truly our patrons who inspire our staff, volunteers, and board members to keep our community connected to the world. To celebrate this honor, IMLS is encouraging Marathon Public Library's community members to share stories, memories, pictures, and videos on social media on Friday, April 16th, 2021, as part of the Share Your Story campaign, using the hashtag IMLSMedals hashtag, and engage with IMLS on Facebook and Twitter. For more information, please visit the IMLS website. We are celebrating not only the ongoing excellence of the best of our museums and libraries, ordinary effects through the pandemic, the recession, the racial justice protest, and national divisions to serve, heal, and bring together our communities, said IMLS Director Crosby Kemper. National Medal winners will be announced in late spring. Representatives from winning institutions will be honored for their extraordinary contributions during a virtual National Medal Ceremony this summer. The National Medal is the nation's highest honor given to museums and libraries that demonstrate significant impact in their communities. For more than 25 years, the award was honored institutions that demonstrate excellence in service to their communities. Suspect in Custody in Brutal Slaying in Alpine, by Big Ben Senna. An Alpine man is currently in custody in Brewster County Jail on suspicion of first-degree felony murder after local authorities say he confessed to killing a fellow Alpine resident. On Saturday evening, Alpine police responded to a call on East Harriet Avenue on the north side of town, near Cockernaw Baseball Park, that was reporting a homicide. Upon arrival, they found Jeffrey Williams, 64, deceased. Alpine police determined Williams had suffered trauma which was not self-inflicted, according to a news release from Alpine PD on Monday. They quickly zeroed in on one man, Travis Rutherford, 37. At press time, it's not clear what caused Alpine police to suspect Rutherford in the killing. The Big Bend Sentinel is working to get more information on the case, including an incident report. If an affidavit in the case, first reported by CBS7, authorities say Rutherford admitted to the killing. They say Rutherford admitted to shooting Williams with a bow and arrow, and that he also hit Williams with a metal bat.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, March 18th, 2021. Tranum Plans to Retire, by Nathan Hewer, Pioneer Editor. After 13 years of service to the Fort Stockton ISD community and 41 years in public education, Ralph Tranum recently announced he will retire after 12 years as superintendent. Tranum's last day in the district will be June 30th, and he will remain an employee of the district until then to assist with the transition. The Board of Trustees began discussions about the superintendent search at their workshop on February 3rd. Under Tranum's tenure, the district is fiscally conservative, maintaining a balanced budget for many years, as well as a strong fund balance despite challenges with state and federal funding. This has helped the district complete numerous construction projects without being a burden to taxpayers. The Fort Stockton community is a special place that supports and values its young people and their education, and the staff in the district are caring, giving people for whom I have the greatest respect, said Tranum. He said school success is all about working together as a team. I have been fortunate to work with wonderful people at Fort Stockton ISD. Our teachers, leadership team, and the school board deserve all of the credit for working together to maximize the success of our students. The district is in excellent shape and will continue to accomplish great things in the future. Tranum has been the superintendent of schools in Fort Stockton ISD since April 2009. Prior to this appointment, he served as the district's assistant superintendent. His vast experience includes periods as a high school principal and high school counselor, as well as a coach and classroom teacher. In 2012, Tranum was named Region 18 Superintendent of the Year. He currently serves on boards for Texas Association Community Schools, Texas Association of Midsize Schools, Region 18 Superintendent Advisory Committee, and he chairs the EdLink 18 Technology Consortium. A Texas native, Tranum was born in Pleasanton. His family relocated to East Texas, where he grew up and graduated from Cushing High School. He received his undergraduate degree in education from Southwest Texas State University and completed a Master's of Education at Texas Tech University. He went on to Saul Ross State University to receive his superintendent certification. Alley-Oop the Caveman and His Pecos County Roots, by Kirby Warnock. In 1927, V.T. Hamlin was working as a poster designer and map maker for the oil industry in Iran. He was stationed in the Yates Field, one of the largest oil fields in the Permian Basin. During this time, he thought about the dinosaurs and other ancient creatures who once roamed the area and created the comic strip character Alley-Oop. On December 5, 1932, Alley-Oop debuted in newspapers across America. Alley-Oop, the strip's title character, was a sturdy citizen who lived in the prehistoric kingdom of Moo. He rode his pet dinosaur, Denny, carried a stone axe, and wore a fur loincloth. He was usually accompanied by his girlfriend, Ula. At its peak, the comic strip was carried in more than 800 newspapers, both as a daily black and white strip and a color one on Sundays. When Hamlin retired in 1971, his assistant, Dave Grau, took over. Grau had been assisting Hamlin since 1950, starting as a letterer and creating the daily solo since July 15, 1966, although co-signed by Hamlin. Hamlin's last signed daily strip appeared December 31, 1972, and his last signed Sunday was April 1, 1973. Through the 70s and 80s, Grau wrote and drew the strip from his North Carolina studio. On December 30, 1991, Jack Bender took on the finishing art chores of the strip. That is, Grau wrote the pencil each strip, after which Bender inked and lettered it and colored it for Sunday strips. Starting September 3, 2001, Alley-Oop Sunday and Daily Strips were drawn entirely by Jack Bender and written by his wife, Carol Bender. In 1960, the Hollywood Argyles had a number one pop hit on the Billboard charts with their song Alley-Oop, sung by Gary Paxton. It featured the lyric, "Look at that caveman go." Today, Alley-Oop is immortalized in Alley-Oop's Fantasyland, a park in Ira Ann, the town where V.T. Hamlin first got the idea. The park was built in 1965 with the full cooperation of Hamlin and a donation of 7 acres of land by the Marathon Oil Company. Hamlin was the guest of honor when the park was dedicated on May 8, 1965. It doesn't take a big leap to see the similarities between Alley-Oop and the TV cartoon series The Flintstones. Denny isn't that far removed from Fred Flintstone's pet dinosaur, Dino. To visit Alley-Oop Fantasyland, take Interstate 10 east out of Fort Stockton to exit 370, U.S. Highway 190. Follow it into the little town of Ira Ann, turn left onto Alley-Oop Lane. Glitzy Trends brings boutique store, coffee shop, and tanning salon together, by Nathan Heuer. Glitzy Trends owner Sonia Vick believes that everything happens for a reason, and to never lose sight of your dreams. The Andrews native made her way to Fort Stockton in 2019 for the first time after a 15-year stay in Colorado, a place where she was an administrative assistant in the medical field, and her husband David Vick worked for Arch Rock. While in Colorado, the timing never proved right for Sonia to start her own boutique or coffee shop. A couple of times we looked at doing a tanning company with a boutique and things like that there, but it wasn't honestly the right time and it wasn't the right place. I believe everything happens for a reason. In 2019, the couple moved to Fort Stockton so David could help take care of his family's ranch while still working for Arch Rock. The change in scenery opened a door for Sonia to do what she had long desired. "I always wanted to have a boutique, so I looked around town to see if there were any boutiques like I was wanting to do, and there wasn't." She and her husband turned her dream into a reality on March 6, 2020, when the couple opened Glitzy Trends, women's clothing and tanning services. "My husband was very supportive with me on my little venture. He was tired of me having to work those 12 to 14-hour days. He knew what my dream was, and he was very supportive. The clothing store offers low to high-end vendors while being zip code protected to ensure it's one of a kind to the area. The boutique also has a men's line that is made from a designer out of Midland." In addition to the clothing store and tanning salon, the 1991 Andrews High School graduate knew she wanted to start a coffee shop as well when she moved to town, as her favorite place to get her espresso beverages was not in town or remotely close. "When there wasn't a Starbucks in town, I was very upset," she said. After the garage had closed its doors, Sonia and David saw a perfect opportunity to start a coffee shop alongside their boutique store. "It was the perfect opportunity to do what I wanted to do. The couple opened Glitzy Brew Coffee Company in the suite right next to the Glitzy Trends Women's Clothing and Tanning Services. This part is nice to be creative and come up with different drinks, she said. We do espresso drinks, cold brews, smoothies. Of course, we got the pastries, infused tea with loose leaf. Actually, I'm using a lady in Colorado. She has over 1,000 loose leaf teas. The coffee shop also offers a variety of activities any given week. Every Friday, the coffee shop hosts a paint and sip session, as well as hosting artists who play live music through the week. As far as the coffee shop goes, we're bringing in local artists. We're trying to get different bands to come, and we had our first concert on Friday with Snotty Hicks. Wednesday this week, I'm doing Al Haney. He's doing saxophone and things like that. We're just trying to give people something to do. So what lies ahead for Glitzy Trends' future? Sonia said with a smile that her daughters and mother know she's not one to keep things the same for too long. It's like I tell my girls, I never know what I'm going to do. I come in every day and say, I have an idea. My mom asked me if I can do anything at any time, and I'm not bred that way. I try to be creative, make changes, and keep people on their toes. Springhurst Hotel Renovations, a Possibility, by Nathan Hewer. A resolution to pass a $1.1 million grant from the Fort Stockton Economic Development Corp. for the Springhurst Hotel renovation project was not passed at the Fort Stockton City Council meeting on February 25th, as the agenda item did not receive any motion after nearly an hour of discussion, which included numerous hotel owners in the area. Since the mid-80s, Fort Stockton has been looking for a contractor to take over the renovation project, according to numerous sources, which is now estimated to be over $5 million. 2 years ago, Apogee Development Group decided to take on the project, but as soon as the pandemic hit, their financing with private equity firms was pulled. The circumstance created a year-long loan application process and a $1.1 million grant that was offered to help persuade them to still take on the project, an amount far less than what other contractors had offered in the past, according to the Fort Stockton EDC Director Remy Ramos. We've had two other people come in, and they've asked the city for way too much money and didn't have secured financing. This group is asking for financing, but it's got the rest all secured. When Ramos presented the resolution for the grant approval at Thursday's council meeting, the EDC director iterated to hotel owners that the Springhurst Hotel would not be in competition with their hotels, but could rather aid their hotel income. Ramos added a week ago that the hotel will have a full-service restaurant, bar, and that the 60-room hotel will have rooms that range from $200 to $250 a night, a number far higher than the average hotel rooms in the area. He added that some people would come to town for just the bar and restaurant while staying at the hotel. We're trying to create a tourism experience and attraction for people to come to Fort Stockton. We understand there is not a big market that can afford that. Then again, why are we having to help? One of the things is the hotel group on the bottom floor is trying to create a high-end restaurant. What we're trying to do is create something that is not here. Councilmen unanimously agreed that it is the wrong time for the grant to be passed for the hotel renovation. Longtime Councilman Ruben Falcon took the lead on discussion after Ramos's presentation, stating he would prefer the money to be a loan rather than giving it as a grant. Falcon also insinuated that the Springhurst would be competition against other hotels. I could be standing up there with those business owners over there. I sat up here for 15 years on this council, and I've sat on the EDC before. I do not think that in any way the government should compete against established businesses. I have an issue with us being the collateral. The Texas Constitution does not allow for a city to allow its name and credit to any private industry. I would be more open to it if this was not part of the loan package. I'm not for a grant to compete against local businesses. Councilman Paul Casillas and James Warnock Both agreed with the fact that the timing is not right, while siding with Falcon when it comes to financing by way of a loan instead of a grant. Hotel owners iterated that they received little money, if any, when they built their hotels, and that they have been struggling a great deal this past year. Rachel Patel, owner of two hotels in Fort Stockton, voiced her objection to the grant at the meeting. You have to understand there are struggling businesses out there. There's businesses that shut down because of COVID, and that $1.1 million could help a lot of people stay open. I feel that Springhurst, they're getting an advantage that none of us got. How can you justify that to the rest of your downtown people? You're opening the door for everyone in downtown, for everyone to come to you for money. Ramos said on March 17th that the EDC is currently working with numerous attorneys to find financing options, which will then be presented to council members as a workshop that does not have a date set yet. FSISD keeps mask mandate in place, by Nathan Heuer. The Fort Stockton Independent School District will keep a mask mandate in place at all their campuses for the rest of the school year, according to Superintendent Gilray Madrid. Madrid said that Thursday's COVID-19 update with the Fort Stockton Pioneer on March 11th that the Texas Education Association met with school administrators the previous week after Abbott's executive order stating that schools need to keep mask mandates in place. They did say that, especially if you can't make sure that people are staying 6 feet apart. They did say that if you are going into the schools as a visitor, you need to wear one as well. One thing TEA emphasized was keeping AC and HVAC unit filters clean and changing them frequently. We're on a plan that we rotate maintenance guys around to change air filters. We've been doing that, disinfecting, cleaning. We're not going to change that because it seems to be working pretty well for us. Our custodians and teachers have got into a good habit of it. The assistant superintendent also addressed the attendance policy for the rest of the school year. Students will still have the opportunity to take classes virtually the rest of the school year, but will need to come in for STAR testing due to the requirement from the state. The state of Texas said you're still going to have to have the STAR test, but you can't take it one at home. We have to encourage kids, virtual learners. TEA is going to require us to document our efforts to make kids come to school to take their STAR tests. They may give us a grade on that. Madrid emphasized the schools are as safe a place as any with hand sanitizers in each classroom and in place. The FSISD has approximately 75% of students attending classes in person. One issue that has arisen from the virtual learning option is students not signing into their Chromebooks and doing their homework. Madrid said that approximately 60 students from all the district's campuses combined are truancy category or are on their way toward being there. Basically, if the kid is not doing anything, we're starting the process to meet with the parents so that the kids can come to school. The last resort, which we don't like to do, is truancy. We've had to go to truancy court, so it's been kind of busy. It's hard to justify when you go to court. The school has given you a Chromebook. The school is letting kids do all these things, and all the kid has to do is log on, see the work, and do the work. The assistant superintendent went on to say that many parents have decided to have their kids attend classes in person, something the teachers prefer. Madrid's statement of the school being the safest place for students is backed by the fact that no students have tested positive for COVID-19, or at least the ones who attend in-person classes, for the past 5 weeks. Where are you headed? A look at people traveling through Fort Stockton, by Jeremy Gonzalez. Fort Stockton gas stations had a busy weekend of spring breakers fueling up for their ride home. Amid all the RVs and travel trailers pulling in, veteran Ivan Johnson found himself marooned here with his 9-week-old puppy, Pretty Girl. I fought two different countries defending this one, so I'm headed to see this country that I fought for, he said. Johnson explained he traveled to Fort Stockton to visit some friends and family, but can't leave until he gets his truck repaired. Being without a vehicle for a month and a half, he sought help by holding up a cardboard sign at Chevron on Saturday. As soon as I get my truck fixed, I'm driving straight to Miami, Oklahoma. It's pretty windy here today, but I think the wind is awesome. I like having all this wind better than the rain. Just got to make sure my sign doesn't fly away. Me and Pretty Girl have just been wandering around town. The people here are nice and laid back. The dogs here are a different story. Yesterday, a little loose dog attacked me. Took a good chunk out of my shirt, that rascal. With a large gash on his arm, Johnson opened his Gatorade and concluded with a toast. Cheers to the horse who never breaks its leg. Let your blessings be many and your trials be few.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahan's News for Thursday, March 18th. Officer involved shooting leaves Phillips dead Saturday. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A Monahan's man was shot and killed Saturday night following an altercation with police. A black man in his early 50s was pronounced dead at the scene by Ward County Justice of the Peace Precinct 1 and 4, Danny Bustos. According to Monahan's Police Department Captain Christopher Quintana, officers were dispatched to the area of 800 South Wilma Street in Thorntonville to assist the Ward County Sheriff's Department and Monahan's Volunteer Fire Department with a grass fire. Quote, during the course of locating several fires in the area, an altercation ensued with a male subject, which resulted in an officer-involved shooting, he added. The shooting left Charles Phillips, age 51, of Monahan's, dead. Some witnesses on the scene reported seeing an individual, presumed to be Phillips, attempting to get into a police cruiser, and other witnesses saw the individual break the window on a police cruiser with a machete and charge toward police officers right before the shooting. However, these statements have not been corroborated. The case has been referred to the Texas Rangers. The officer involved in the shooting has been placed on paid administrative leave until the investigation is complete, Quintana said. The name of the officer was not released. Monahan's Wicked Pyote ISD cancels mask mandate. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. The wearing of masks for Monahan's Wicked Pyote ISD will be optional, effective March 29th, based on action taken by the trustees in Monday night's meeting. The trustees passed a resolution modifying face covering protocols within the district that eliminates the requirements to wear face coverings for students, staff, and visitors, but strongly encourages all to wear face coverings at school. The mandate could be reinstated if, 1, there is new guidance from the governor of Texas mandating wearing of masks, 2, an order from the county judge, and or 3, the superintendent of schools finds that a significant outbreak of COVID-19 within the school community warrants reinstating the mandate. Quote, we are waiting for 2 weeks after spring break before implementation to make sure we don't have any issues when kids return to school on March 15th as the result of possible exposures during spring break, Superintendent Chad Smith said. After meeting in closed session to discuss contracts for assistant principals, counselors, speech pathologist, occupational therapist, and chief of police, all contracts were renewed by unanimous vote when the trustees returned to open session. The trustees also approved the asbestos abatement plan for the bus barn project at a cost of $22,000. The abatement will require abatement of approximately 3,500 asbestos floor tiles and 3 portable storage buildings. The cost is $7,200 to Corral Environmental Consulting for project design and management and $15,600 to Vanco Insulation to perform the abatement. The cost will be paid from 2019 bond proceeds. Grand Falls Royalty ISD teacher placed on administrative leave. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. an apparent threat to students and staff members at the campus of the Grand Falls Royalty ISD campus has resulted in heightened security measures and a teacher placed on administrative leave. A reliable source told the news that Anthony Flowers of Fort Stockton and a teacher at GRISD said he had blueprints of the school, could shoot and kill every person in the school, and, because of the remoteness of the community, could get it done before any help could get to the school. The incident reportedly occurred before spring break. Superintendent Brett Starkweather, in a phone call to the news, would not confirm the name of the teacher, but acknowledged a teacher had been placed on administrative leave and that heightened security measures had been put in place, although he would not elaborate on the details of those measures. Quote, "The incident is still under investigation, and I cannot make any further comments," Starkweather said. Starkweather sent the following letter to the community. Quote, "Threats of school violence can breed fear, anxiety, and frustration for educators, students, and parents. While the vast majority of threats turn out to be without merit, we at Grand Falls Royalty ISD investigate and take very seriously any threat toward the safety of our students and staff. Recently, there has been a report of possible school violence at GRISD. While we continue to be vigilant over these safety concerns, we want parents to know that the statements were thoroughly investigated by both district administration and law enforcement. We ask that students and parents be discerning when choosing to repeat information that is vague, lacks details, or credibility, or is inconsistent. This type of behavior leads to continued misinformation and cultivates unnecessary fear and anxiety in our school community. We are writing this letter to inform parents that we are confident that GRISD is a safe learning environment. We appreciate the concerns of parents and will continue to communicate on all educational issues, including school safety. Sincerely, Brett Starkweather, Superintendent. Sales tax locally, statewide, drop. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Despite what appears to be an increase in oil field activity, sales tax revenues across the area do not reflect that. Of the 18 area entities monitored by the Monahans News, only two had an increase over March of last year, Pyote and Ira Ann, and two are up for the year-to-date, Crane and Ira Ann. Texas Comptroller Glenn Hager sent cities, counties, transit systems, and special purpose taxing districts $762.5 million in local sales tax allocations for March, 0.5% less than in March 2020. These allocations are based on sales made in January by businesses that report tax monthly. Monahans is down for both the month of March and so far for the year. The drop from the February report is down even further. Monahans received $246,000 for March compared to $374,900 last year, a decline of 34%. For the year, Monahans is down to $886,000 compared to $1.1 million for the first 3 months last year. Last month, Monahans received $428,000. MEDC approves LIDAR services. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Board members of the Monahans Economic Development Corporation, MEDC, met for their monthly meeting on Monday and approved a master service agreement with Half Associates for survey support services for the new fiber loop internet conduit to serve the commercial and industrial business in Monahans. MEDC Director Ashley Adalto told the group, quote, "Last month, Carol Faulkner talked about the first step in the design process of the broadband is to establish the base map using LIDAR and after talking to several groups, he was actually able to get this group to come down on their price, end quote. MEDC will pay half associates 12 cents per mile for data collection, estimated to be 75 miles, and 40 cents per mile for the extraction services, estimated to be 25 miles. Half associates will be tasked with providing data collection and extraction services using mobile light detection and ranging technology, or LIDAR. Mobile LIDAR is performed by collecting the data using LIDAR equipment that is fixed on top of a vehicle. The vehicle drives along streets and alleys and collects three-dimensional data points, millions per second, and creates a point cloud. These 3D features include items such as light poles, power poles, guy wires, overhead facilities, fire hydrants, pedestals, traffic signal boxes, and other above-ground utilities and structures. This information is then converted for use in a design program that is used to create the construction plans and specifications. This network design information also provides a critical component for use in network operations. Representatives with half associates are scheduled to come out early next week, Adalto added. Construction on the broadband project is expected to begin in the summer. In November, a $1.5 million federal grant was approved for the project. The total project cost was expected to be about $3 million, and the grant required 20% to come from local funds. In other business, the board approved a rezoning classification for the two Main Street properties located on the corner of 8th and Main Street and 802 South Main from an R3 multifamily dwelling to a C1 local retail. Both properties were purchased by MEDC for the amount of $214,000 to be developed for a future retail business. Rezoning the property will also combine the two lots into one single lot. Quote, I have a franchise interested in the property, and it would be easier for them if the property was already rezoned for a commercial building, Adalto said. Since the request was approved, the request will now go in front of the Planning and Zoning Board for approval at their next meeting. Although Adalto did not know the name of the franchise interested, she did say it was, quote, a food and drink franchise, end quote. In regular business, the directors approved accounts payable for the month of January, totaling $15,800, which included $7,700 to Faulkner Consulting, LLC, for design phase project management, and $8,100 for payroll and salaries. The financial report, reflecting a balance of $2 million in available funds, and minutes of the February 22nd regular meeting were approved. Directors present were Richard Irwin, Hal Upchurch, Brian Franks, Eddie Nelms, and Camilla Blum.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.